Hi, and welcome to Terra Nullius Cyprus. I'm Costa Constanti. With me today, I have Navid Costandino, who I've just recently met. And Navid is something that not many people are aware of exists as a career. He's an oceanographer. Did I say that right?
You said it very well, very right.
Yeah. I said it right, so I'm not embarrassing myself.
No.
Well, before we find out what an oceanographer is, I'm guessing just by the word ocean, it has something to do with the ocean.
It did.
And probably not graphs. But anyway, you'll tell us in a second. First, I want to know, who are you? Where did you grow up?
I'm Navid, as you pointed out. I grew up in Lefkosia, in the center of Nicosia, and then I went to Greece to study physics, and I was there for 12 years. I studied physics, and then I did more studies, and PhD, and whatnot.
All in Greece?
All in Greece, Athens. Okay. In Athens. Mm-hmm. I was there for 12 years. And then I've worked in the US, and now the past 6 years in Australia, down under.
Well, Australia's the bit that interests me a lot, but we'll come back to that. So you were for 12 years in Athens.
Yeah.
How was that compared to living in Cyprus?
Athens is a big city, big metropolitan city, a lot of things going on. I was really excited to head out of Cyprus when I headed out. It was time for me to go, and it was really fun living in Athens. Very, very vibrant city. I had a lot of fun. By the 12th year, it started being a little bit tiring, the chaos and the noise.
Jungle.
Yes, I was ready to head out, yeah.
Yeah, well, look, I mean, Nicosia, where you grew up, can be a bit of a concrete jungle, but it's very short distance to get out of town and escape it. But in Greece, in Athens, it can be consuming.
Oh, it's an order of magnitude bigger.
Yeah. So, okay, you studied 12 years. Remind me, your first degree was in physics, wasn't it?
Physics, yes.
What is physics?
Physics, it's the study of nature, essentially. Mm-hmm. Physicists try to look at nature and understand how it works.
Mm-hmm.
And when I say really understand how it works, so that we can make predictions for things in nature we don't see yet, or to understand things that we don't know still.
Did you go in thinking you knew something about the world, but then by the time you finished your studies, you realized there was a lot you didn't know?
Not really.
No.
I went a little bit oblivious. Yeah. I went because I liked doing maths and physics at school. And I thought I knew what physics was.
Mm-hmm.
And in the second year when I was there, in the second year of the university, I really realized what physics was. It had nothing to do with what I thought it was.
Yeah.
But fortunately, it was something I really liked even more.
Okay,
so then I was lucky to, okay, I'm good here. It's good.
That was your bachelor's in physics.
Yeah.
And then you went and did what, master's? Or?
Yeah, I stayed in the physics department and did a master's and a PhD.
What university?
In National Kapodistrian University of Athens.
Okay, fine university.
Oh, thank you.
Well done. And that was in Greek. The studies were in Greek.
The studies were in Greek.
Yeah.
Of course, after the first degree, after the bachelor's, when I started doing research, research was in English.
Yeah.
Like you read international papers, you write in English usually. But the courses were in Greek.
Okay, all right. And so then from Greece, you finished your studies, you got your PhD, and then instead of staying in Greece or coming back to Cyprus, you then went to the US?
I went to the US, yes.
Where in the US?
I was in California, in San Diego, in the University of California, San Diego.
Mm-hmm. So you had the Cypriot weather follow you there?
Yeah, or I followed it. Yes, it was really, the weather there is really comparable to the Mediterranean climate, yeah.
So in San Diego, what did you go to do?
So in San Diego, in UC San Diego, there is a big oceanographic institution, one of the two biggest institutions in the US, in the world probably one of the biggest. There's one in the East Coast of the US and one in the West Coast. In the West Coast is this one, Scripps Oceanography Institution. And I got a fellowship to go work there as a postdoctoral researcher. Wow. There was a person there I knew I knew their work very well, and I was excited to work with them, so I went there, and as soon as I arrived there, so then I, okay, now I'm an oceanographer. That's what I was.
Before we ask more about the States, what is an oceanographer? And I think now's the time you can tell us what that is.
Yeah, well, oceanographers study the ocean.
Mm-hmm.
There are several aspects of the ocean, like some people study marine life of the ocean,
mm-hmm.
Or biology of the ocean. It could be plankton even.
Mm-hmm.
Some others study physics of the ocean, like how water moves around.
Like
how,
the currents and the heat in the
water. Yeah, how the water moves around, mm-hmm. how the currents move around, how the ocean interacts with the air above it,
mm-hmm.
Or with the mountains beneath it.
Mm-hmm.
There are geophysicists of the ocean that study the core, the earth below the ocean, for mm-hmm. example. Mm-hmm. And then within those categories, there are people who are doing observations. They go out to sea and measure the ocean. Mm-hmm. They may put instruments in the water. There are people who do numerical modeling.
Mm-hmm.
They study the ocean using computers.
Yep.
And there are other people who are doing theory, like, you know, using pen and paper. They try to develop mathematical theory to explain the processes they see, the physical.
So now, were you doing all of these, or were you specifically homing in on one part of all this?
I'm not an observationalist.
Mm-hmm.
I'm definitely not doing that. I started as a theoretician.
Mm-hmm.
That's what my PhD was more focused on, like developing mathematical theories to try to understand how fluids work in general and the ocean or the atmosphere. And through the years after working post my PhD, I have developed a very strong inclination into computer modeling. Okay. And scientific computers. So I'm now somewhere in between being a physicist and a computer scientist, say.
Okay. So how long were you in San Diego?
I was there for almost 3 years.
3 years, okay. It's a long time. I was in Monterey, just north of San Francisco. No, south of San Francisco.
It's a bit south, yeah.
Yeah, between Los Angeles and San Francisco.
Yeah.
And I remember...
It's a nice place.
It's a beautiful place. It's a very expensive place. And the people that live there are certainly of a different caliber of economy to me. But whilst I was in Monterey, I went to the... I'm not sure if it's an aquarium or an oceanarium.
It's an aquarium. They do research also there.
Correct, yeah. And I did find fascinating when I was there, they had along the town's waterfront, they had all these billboards explaining different things about marine life and also about the currents and also weather patterns like El Nino and El Nina.
Yeah.
And I remember thinking, here I am being, was born in Melbourne, grew up on the eastern, southeastern Australia, where El Nino and El Nina was a predominant feature of our weather patterns there. And here I am in California on the other side of that where El Nino does the loop and comes around, you know. And I remember thinking how small this huge planet actually is. And it's ironic what I say, because what happens on the coastline of California affects the coastline of Australia and the rest of the world, of course.
Sure.
Part of your modeling and this research you do, let's say, I'm assuming it wasn't just focused on the coastline of California. It would have the repercussions further afield, correct?
Yeah. So, like some people, when they study the ocean, they study the region
mm-hmm.
near them or some particular region. I study the ocean in general. So when I model the ocean, I'm either modeling a small piece of the ocean, but in a very idealized setting, trying mm-hmm. to understand what sort of physical things are happening,
mm-hmm.
or I'm just modeling the whole global ocean. So okay. I'm not focused on one particular region next to Australia or next yeah. to the California or next to California or wherever. I'm trying to understand how the ocean works as a whole and how water moves around in the whole ocean. It's all connected. It's all one ocean, essentially.
Well, indeed. So you, from California, from San Diego, you did 3 years. And
yep.
from there, you ended up in Australia?
Yep.
How did that happen?
Like everything in life, there's a lot of randomness and chance.
Serendipity.
Yeah. I was looking for a next contract after mm-hmm. my contract was finishing up. And there was like a job opening in Johns Hopkins in Baltimore. Mm-hmm. And there was another one at the Australian National University in Canberra. Mm-hmm. I applied to both. I got offered both. And I knew, I had heard about the group in Canberra, that there was like a really nice vibe. I knew the head of the group there a little bit. Mm-hmm. And I asked around and I couldn't hear something negative about that group. So I said, okay, I'll go there.
Okay, yeah. Well, look, it's hard. I mean, I'm biased. I mean, it's hard to find negativity from Australia. That's just me being biased. But Canberra, the Australian Capital Territory, other than Jervis Bay, which is on the coast, the district, the state itself doesn't have a coastline.
Sure.
So being an oceanographer in a landlocked district, how does that work?
Well, because we are not doing observations, me and the group mm-hmm. there, we are mm-hmm. mostly focused on climate modeling and mm-hmm. you know, modeling the ocean. You don't necessarily have to be close to the ocean. You can model the ocean from wherever you are. And a lot of other, there are a lot of big universities that are focused on ocean modeling and they're not in...
Anywhere near the sea. So how do you collect your data? Is it from satellites or is it from buoys out at sea? Like how does the information come to you in inland?
Yeah, one very big source of information, if mm-hmm. we want to compare with how the real ocean is, yes, mm-hmm. one source of information is satellites. Mm-hmm. Satellites can observe really well the surface of the ocean, mm-hmm. not the interior.
Sure. So when you say they observe the surface of the ocean, is that the movements or the temperatures or the...
Both.
Okay.
Both. Both the movements, so the surface currents mm-hmm. and the temperatures and salinity, yep. I think. Yes.
Yeah. Okay.
But also there's a big network of... floats, they call them Argo floats. Mm-hmm. Imagine them like torpedoes, and then they float around at 1,000 meters deep,
right,
all over the ocean. They float up, and then at some point they dive down to 2,000 meters, and then they dive up to the surface, and they gather data while doing that, and then they transmit it to satellites. So there are a lot of these all over the world, and so that's another source of information.
Who plants or places these?
I think the main university that orchestrates or started this project is Scripps Institution for Oceanography in mm-hmm. California, mm-hmm. but it's a global collaboration at this point.
I think the data is accessible to everybody?
Yes, okay. Yes, yes. In general, in science, we have this philosophy, and it's becoming more and more prominent, mm-hmm. that data is for all. It's okay. It's not like I collected the data, I will use the data. Yeah. I collect the data for everybody. And, okay. You just pay attribution, you cite, you put proper acknowledgement to mm-hmm. where you got your data, and that's the payment in quotation marks, okay. for those people. We get data from that source, but also even from observational cruises, we are in Canberra in a landlocked city, but we collaborate very closely with University of New South Wales, of the University of Tasmania. Mm-hmm. Usually all the research cruises in Australia head out from University of Tasmania.
Okay.
And because Australia, for geographic reasons, has a bit of focus in the Southern Ocean, in Antarctica, a lot of mm-hmm. Research cruises start from Tasmania and go down to Antarctica.
Yeah.
So it's not that then Tasmania has the data and it's mine. It's we share everything.
So now you were in Canberra, the ANU, you said, Australian yes. National University.
Okay.
No, it's a very prestigious university as well. You know how to pick them. Well, they know how to pick you, I should say.
Good. Yeah. Both ways. It goes both ways.
Now, did you spend most of your time in Canberra, or did you get out a little bit? Like, did you go down the coastline, or
I went down the coast a lot. Yes, yeah. I love the ocean. Mm-hmm. Like, outside of work, mm-hmm. I also like the ocean a lot. Mm-hmm. I like to go into the ocean, not for research, for fun. Mm-hmm. So yeah, every other weekend I was down at the coast the first couple of years while I was living in Canberra. Then COVID hit at some point. And
everyone's favorite moment in time.
Yeah, yeah, it was quite fun. It was a bit cute in the beginning, the first 3-4 weeks. But then
the novelty wore off quickly.
Yeah, yeah, I was ready to go back to normal life. But during COVID, because nobody was going in the office anyway, I thought, okay, I'll move down to the coast. So I moved down to the coast. I found a really nice small community of people there in a very small coastal town. Town of 500 people. So then I stayed down at the coast, living next to the sea, and I was commuting up to Canberra for 2 days a week out of five.
Okay. So when you say you're living in a small community of about 500 people, much like Cyprus, you must have known everyone in the village and everyone knew you.
Yeah, after a couple of months, it was like that. Yeah. You would walk down to grab coffee and you would hear, oh, hi, Navid. Good day, Navid. You would go to the coffee shop, they make your coffee. It was exactly like that.
Now, living on the coastline of New South Wales versus the coastline of California, was there a lot of similarities, or would you say they were very different places? I mean, California is quite densely populated compared to New South Wales.
Yeah, that was the biggest. That was the biggest difference that in California, in where I was in San Diego. Yeah, it's a lot of people.
Yeah.
A lot of people. It's not, it doesn't have the vibe of a small coastal town.
Yeah.
I would guess that, you know, if I was closer to Sydney or Newcastle, it would be similar. I've visited those places. It has some, similarities.
In the microcosm, like if you're in 2-3 streets of busy concrete jungle, well, then you could be anywhere.
But yeah. But where I lived, it didn't have that vibe. It had a very, very chill vibe. You know, you would go usually to the beach, you would see 2-3 people and you might even think, oh, there's too many people here, let's go to the next bay.
Yeah. Well, that's the beauty of Australian coastlines, actually. You can have kilometers and thousands of kilometers to yourself. And like you said, when you see someone else, you're like, oh, well, it's crowded here, let's move on.
Yeah, let's go to the next one.
I mean, I'm not sure, did you get down to the Great Ocean Road in Victoria?
I've been there, yes. I've been there a couple of times.
I mean, a few times that I'd been there as well, I'd been, you know, down on the beach relaxing and somebody was like, you know, in the distance, I could see them on the horizon. So I picked up my things and moved on because like that was, I felt it was an invasion of space. Now that I live in Cyprus, I'm happy if I can see the sand, let alone...
You change perspective.
You change perspective. You most certainly do. I mean, there are places in Cyprus where you can enjoy it. But coming back to the science of all this oceanography, you're looking at all these different elements of the environment of the sea. Now, what was it that you've seen? What's your concern? What draws your attention the most with everything you've looked at? Like, are you seeing warning signs out in the sea, in the ocean? Are you seeing positivity? What are you seeing? Like, you know, don't tell us the world is ending next week, but give us
I will actually never tell you that.
No, yeah. Okay, you don't want to cause panic.
First is this.
Yeah.
But second, I think the news have a little bit of a tendency for catastrophology, which I don't really like it. There's one positive thing about the catastrophology, because we are actually in sort of a crisis, climate crisis. So exaggerating a bit in the news to make the public a bit more alarmed and aware, it's good, because that put pressures on the politicians, which is where the pressure should go in the end. Because if I decide to, you know, do a little bit of few good things to save the planet, that's good if we each of us decide to do that. But if governments don't decide to put policies on, you know, on companies or on emissions, that's then, you know, like what individuals do it's minor. So that's the only good thing I find about this catastrophology.
But what we do as individual private persons, each individual one of us, maybe not contributing or saving the world on our own, but times 7 billion people,
Definitely.
But also, I think what's more important, you touched on it, is that the pressure that we put on the government to put pressure on the big companies, the,
yes,
I don't know, whatever it is, the oil producers, the plastic makers, the polluters in general, the big polluters.
Yeah.
But what do you see is the number, give us the 1, 2, or 3 points that you see that we need to really tackle right now. Like what are the key things that we need to, as a humanity, as a species?
Yeah. I have a difficulty talking about that as a scientist.
Mm-hmm.
Because my science is a little bit detached of practicalities of like, oh, you know, I'm predicting this quantity, so we need mm-hmm. to do this mm-hmm. today or tomorrow.
Mm-hmm.
My science is a little bit more, I'm trying to understand the basics of how climate works,
yep,
and make climate models better.
Okay.
Because that's, at the moment, our only tool for projecting the climate and predicting how the climate will be in 50, yep, 100 years' time. But as a person, mm-hmm, I have strong opinions of what we should do. We should definitely reduce emissions,
mm-hmm,
CO2 emissions, to the best we can. We should definitely put forward some carbon tax, mm-hmm, and then promote cleaner energy sources,
mm-hmm,
and we should try to try to admit to ourselves that that we will have to do some sacrifices from our personal lifestyle in order to for this to happen. So it would be ideal if we can change everything, become green without changing our lifestyle.
Mm-hmm.
But I think that's not the case. So
it's something that I think most people are reluctant to do, to change their lifestyles, because we're creatures of habit.
Sure.
And we've learned a certain way of doing things, and we like to believe that we can continue doing what we're doing and let the authorities and the big companies do the changes so that
sort everything out.
Yeah, and I think it does need to come a bit from both ends. We can all do our little bit, but I do think that the bigger picture things need to be done as well.
Yes.
Is it true that the sea, the ocean, the body of water is Earth's canary in the mine? What I mean by that is, you know, the miners used to take the canary into the mine, and if the canary died, then there's gas,
yeah,
they all evacuate. Is the ocean what gives us the view to the immediate future quicker than other parts of Earth?
I'm not sure exactly about this analogy, but definitely the ocean is a very big sink of the extra carbon we put in the atmosphere.
Uh-huh.
Up to now, the excess carbon, like we have put in the atmosphere post-industrial revolution, 90% of that is stored in the ocean.
90%?
Yes.
Since the industrial revolution. Yeah,
I'm talking about the excess that we've put as humans.
Okay.
Yeah, so.
So this is, and it's stored in the sea.
Somehow the ocean can capture carbon and then it can take it down to its abyss.
Is that good? Is that good news?
The ocean acts as a sink of carbon, and it's mm-hmm. good. If the ocean was not there,
yeah,
and so we would have been feeling the effects of climate change 10 times more. I mean, as creatures,
like humans on the ground, breathing air,
living in the atmosphere. So the ocean is helping. In the moment, it acts as a buffer.
And you said
it cannot be doing that forever, though.
It can't be doing that forever. But if this is the sea, is the ocean deep enough and big enough to sustain this for a couple hundred more years? Or
I don't think a couple of hundred more years is okay. The numbers we're talking about, because already it's been doing it for a lot. And doing that, the ocean properties change. Like it's become more acidic a little bit. You know, putting more carbon. It's like the same thing as, you know, you carbonize the water and then it starts becoming bubbly. You cannot be doing that forever. There's like a threshold. So I'm not sure exactly if we, how close enough we are on that threshold, but we cannot be relying on the ocean keep that it will keep doing it. So it's all right for us to pumping out extra CO2.
As the ocean absorbs the carbon and changes the pH or whatever of the water, this must obviously be affecting sea life, from animals to plankton to seaweed to...
Yeah, a little bit we've seen these effects at the moment. I don't know if we know how these effects are manifested, like if, you know, ocean biologists really know. But yes, it does. It will definitely affect
at some point. So everything I know about oceanography, I've just learned in the last few minutes with you.
Yeah.
If we miraculously today stopped excess carbon production, will the sea slowly release this carbon back into the air and we'd be breathing it for the next millennia? Or is it in the water forever and that's it? Have we passed that threshold of no return? Like, is that the new world's water now?
No, I don't. It's not about so for that carbon to come up again. Mm-hmm. It's, you know, the whole ocean circulation has to change. I think we can think of that carbon being in the ocean for the next whatever years. Like a big change in the ocean circulation must happen for that carbon to come up.
Does all this change in the seas and everything, does it change, other than the actual chemical nature of the water, the pH and everything, does it affect currents or movement or density?
No, it's a little bit the vice versa. But wherever currents are and however the circulation of the ocean is, it affects which parts of the ocean can take up carbon from the atmosphere and put it down.
Okay.
So a change in, say, for example, there's a big current that goes around Antarctica.
Yep.
That's the biggest current in Earth. It's called the Antarctic Circumpolar Current. Okay. If that current shifts a little bit, it goes northward or southward by a few hundred of kilometers. Although this may seem minor in the big picture of Earth, or, you know, what's a few hundred of kilometers like in our huge Earth, which is like 40,000 kilometers in diameter in those in that region, it might have a very big effect on how much carbon the ocean can take in or take out, or it could start releasing where it was taking in. So changes in the ocean currents may have a big effect on this, on how much
what can change an ocean's current?
How can they change?
Yeah, like is this something that humans cause, or is this a natural phenomenon?
Well, both. Mm-hmm. Both. Well, the effect of how much is human and how much is natural is open.
Okay.
But changes in the atmospheric circulation, for example, if you heat up the atmosphere, and we've been doing that a little bit. Then where the winds are, the patterns of the winds, they may shift a little bit or strengthen or weaken.
Okay.
And then the winds are the winds that flow over the ocean, drive the ocean circulation. That's one of the drivers of the ocean circulation. Other drivers exist also. But so, you know, by it is, you know, the climate is really an intricate system of a lot of things, like the ocean, the atmosphere, the sea ice. Even trees and biology on land, the rivers, everything is quite intimately connected. So if you change one thing...
The domino effect.
There is a little bit of a domino effect. And the whole system, you know, a lot of things might change so that the system finds its new equilibrium.
Okay.
And the climate system is not really anthropocentric, so it will find an equilibrium. What do you
mean? We're not at the center of nature. It doesn't revolve just around us.
We're not.
So basically, you're saying that the world can equalize or find its equilibrium, but it could come at our cost.
It won't necessarily think, oh, we need to, keep, coastal cities intact because there are a lot of people there. I mean, the system might find an equilibrium, which could be with 5 meters of sea level rise or whatever.
Yeah.
You know, so that everything is in equilibrium. Otherwise,
let me play devil's advocate.
Yeah,
we've seen the history of Earth shows that the sea levels have dropped and risen a few times over the millennia, right? Over the millions of years.
Yep.
For example, using Australia as an example, you could walk from Melbourne to Tasmania once,
yep,
and sea level rising cut that bridge off. It's not the first time the water has gone up or down. The difference, as you said now, is that nature isn't, you know, focusing on what it can do best for humans. It does what it does naturally. So you're right. If the sea level is going to go up, it's going to go up regardless if you have a city on the coastline or not. But is this something that's unavoidable regardless of what we do? I mean, are we as humans really making such a big difference to the environment that we're changing the natural direction of Earth's physical history?
Well, yeah, again, this is an open question. Mm. Some would say yes, some would say no, some would say we're not quite sure.
Not sure, yeah.
I think what you were thinking when you were saying about this, like, you know, for example, when you said there was like at once you could walk from Australia to Tasmania, was like times that we had ice ages, or times that we had the climate like today.
Yeah.
So that's a big change. Mm-hmm. So, you know, as soon as you have ice ages, there's a much more ice formed in the
polar caps.
In the polar caps, much more glaciers. Mm-hmm. So a lot of ice, like, you know, you have like 4 kilometers of snow on top of Berlin, for example. So all this water,
mm-hmm,
I mean, it doesn't come from somewhere else. It, like, the climate system is a closed system, so it comes from the sea. So the sea level goes down when that happens. But so, yes, those changes have been known to happen, you know, in the past 1 million years, for example. And but then you're asking now, are these changes we're seeing now a little bit of that? That would happen naturally, or have we been pushing it, the system a little bit? My intuition is that it's not just my intuition. The scientific evidence is kind of like showing us that we have been pushing the system a little bit, definitely to some degree.
Yep.
Now, how much of the changes that we've seen, you know, the more climate extremes, more tropical storms, more extreme weather phenomena, how much of this is because we've pushed the system and changed a little bit, or how much it's naturally occurring, it's an open question.
Well, look, and your point, again, I like to bring it up a third time. The point that you said is that it's not
anthropocentric.
Anthropocentric. It wouldn't be such an issue if we were Bedouins or, you know, nomadic people. We just move on to greener pastures or where there's fresher water. You know, if this area that we're living in is, you know, being swamped by rising seas or desertification or whatever, we just move somewhere else.
Sure.
Which would be fine if that's where we were as a human species.
Yeah.
But we're not, as you said. And, I mean, we can't pick up New York or Melbourne or Nicosia and then put it somewhere else overnight. It's a slow burn. I mean, there are already places on Earth, like in the Pacific Islands, where they are already talking about moving villages and cities, well, not cities yet, but towns along these small atolls, which are already starting to be submerged. Or other places like, I mean, I was looking at this data in India where, now I can't remember if it was on west or the east side, but one side of India is getting drier faster and the other side is getting wetter faster. And, you know, everyone talks about, we used to say it was global warming, but now the more popular term, or the more correct term, is climate change. Because I can clearly remember Trump during one of these ice storms saying, you see, you know, we've had the coldest winter on record, so global warming is hogwash. And the scientists were coming out saying, no, no, no. It still is warming, but we're calling it climate change because when it gets hotter in one place, it offsets somewhere else, cooler elsewhere. I mean, and you said earlier that everything that's within our planet, it doesn't grow, diminish, shrink, or grow. It's one piece of nature that if you pull on one end, it tugs the other end. You take away water from here, it's going to reappear somewhere else. If you take heat over here, cold's going to appear there. I'm making it sound really, really simplistic, and that's because that's where I am in this. That's how educated I am on the topic. But look, I mean, we're not moving humanity in a hurry to safer places. So, if we were to reverse the damage we've done since the Industrial Revolution, and more so the last 100 years, from what I understand, is it too late to? I mean, the school's still out. The verdict is still out. Whether we are causing it or how much we are causing it is all up for debate. You're saying that we are causing it somewhat. We don't know how much, but we are causing it. Let's use that as our basis, that we are causing it.
Yep.
How quickly can we reverse it? I mean, we had COP24, what was it, in Dubai, where they were saying that, you know, and the Paris agreements. You know, and we don't look like we're going to match any of these targets we're going for. And even if we do, they're saying that the damage is already done. It's already too late. How bad are we talking? Like, I mean, is it? Do we bother?
It's hard for me to make statements like in this direction. Also, I mean, also, I don't know exactly what do you mean. How fast can we reduce it? Are you asking how fast could the politicians come into an agreement? I have no idea about that.
No, but can we? Like, I mean, can we see in our lifetime? I mean, we all live up to, let's say, 100 if we're lucky. Yeah. Will we see in our lifetime, if we do everything right, if the whole world comes together, kind of like it did for the pandemic, if we've actually all come together and actually not only sign all these agreements, but actually implement them, let's say that miracle occurs and everyone comes to the party, mm-hmm. will we see in our lifetime a cessation or a slowdown of this climate change? Do you think it's possible?
It's a good question. I actually don't know the answer. Mm-hmm. I haven't... Yeah, I don't know. Say if you're saying, say tomorrow, all the policies, all the goals are met for carbon emissions, whatever, the most optimistic scenario, how long until we reach pre-industrial levels of what we feel as climate?
Yeah.
Actually, it's a good question. I don't know what's the response time of the system.
Yeah, I mean, because we've never tried it.
Yes, we've tried it the other way.
Yeah, so it doesn't work.
But we know if sometimes complicated non-linear systems are not like that, but if we assume that the response time is similar, so I would expect that in our lifetime we'll see some change, because in the other way we've increased our emissions and in 50, 60 something years we've seen change, we've experienced change. So if we reduce our emissions now, I would expect that in a similar timescale we'll experience, but that's a guess. And based on the assumption that the system is symmetric. Sometimes going one way is sluggier or faster than going the other way.
Also be disastrous going the other way, maybe. We haven't tried it. We've never done it. We've never gone from being a negative contributor to the environment to being a positive contributor to the environment. We don't know whether we could tip the balance perhaps the wrong way. That's me being a pessimist.
I don't think the whole goals that are met are, going the other way. Just going...
Slowing down
or going to zero, not even. We're not talking about taking out carbon from the system.
No. Well, I've got one last question because we're running out of time. But we can look into the soil of Earth and see the history of the soil. We go down the layers and we can see the different layers of Earth. We can see tectonic movement evidence. We can see particles from volcanic eruptions. We can see, where this area was flooded, how many millennia ago. We can do that with ice as well. We can bore into the Antarctic ice. We can see...
We do that with ice a lot, actually. That's a very good proxy for paleoclimate records.
Yes. Okay, that was part of my question. We can't... I'm guessing there's no physical evidence on the history of the ocean's currents, correct? I mean, how would you know 5 million years ago the current was XYZ? Is there any way to find that evidence?
Well, there's ways to find indirect evidence. That's not actually my expertise, but there's definitely ways to find how the continents were, mm-hmm. like, you know, X, Y, Z million years ago.
Yeah.
And if then you have a good estimation of what the winds were, mm-hmm. then you can plug in all this into an ocean model and see how the currents will that be with these different...
So you need to use the computers and AI and whatnot to predict what possibly was the case.
Yes, yeah. You know, there's like a mixture of... That's one way to do it.
Mm-hmm.
And people are doing these things. Mm-hmm. You know, they're shifting continents around and say, yeah. Okay, when... You know, whatever. Yeah. This continent was in this different position.
India was in Mozambique. And
yes, how was the circulation? Mm-hmm. And you can answer these questions.
Okay.
Yes. You know, of course, there's some assumptions there. But but you could, if you have an idea, or sometimes there's like indirect evidence that you can see in the ocean's floor or in like... You know, like by drilling in corals.
Yeah.
I'm not an expert. I cannot really know. I don't know how to describe what do people see, and they can infer how the circulation was. But you know, it's like it's a pretty good Sherlock Holmes type of situation that some scientists do, and sometimes they are really good at that. Like, you know, inferring, for example, from corals, what the temperature conditions were there, and then if you say, oh, the temperature had to be the current must have been shifted towards the north or the south.
Okay.
Things like that can be inferred. Yeah.
You know, speaking of the ocean floor, maybe you've heard this as well. I don't know how true it is, but I read somewhere that the sea floor to the west of Cyprus is the world's oldest exposed sea floor.
I'm not sure about that.
Neil, I mean, I don't know if it's true. I mean, this is out of my mind, but I remember reading that somewhere, and I tried to understand, and apparently, like, as the continents shift, as tectonic plates slide under and over each other, and as, you know, silt and movements went, but apparently this article, and I don't remember where I read it now, but it was saying that the sea floor between Cyprus and Crete, perhaps, there was the oldest sea floor that... hasn't gone under or over or been replaced or whatever. And I thought that was quite fascinating. And I think some university, might have been the Hebrew University in Israel, I'm not sure, we're going to go and do some research there to see like a photograph, like a 10-million-year-old photograph of the sea floor.
I see. Yeah.
And I thought that was quite fascinating, because then it got me interested in the Eratosthenes Mount south of the island and all this. But look, your
You'll have to show me, I'm intrigued now. Never heard this.
But yeah, I found it quite fascinating, but I don't know if it was just, you know, Cyprus trying to be the oldest and the center of everything, you know, it could be.
It could be a little bit, but
But I'll find out for you. But the other thing, just as one last question, the studying the ocean in the Pacific, and you've looked at it from both ends. You looked at it from the U.S. northern end, mm-hmm. so the northeast of the Pacific, and now you're looking at it from the southwest. What you learn in the Pacific, is it applicable to the Mediterranean, or are we talking about a totally different system here?
It's a very different system, yes. Yeah. I mean, the Pacific has... But you know, I'll take it one step back.
Okay.
I don't even see myself like I was looking the ocean from the California side or from the Australian side.
Yeah.
I'm looking at the ocean as a whole. Yes, the Pacific has, you know, it's a very big ocean. First of all, it includes the tropics. It includes phenomena where this phenomena starts like El Niño, which usually starts at the coast of Peru. Mm-hmm. And it's El Niño is... it's a phenomenon where we see every 6-7 years, like, and the sea becomes a couple of degrees warmer on the side of Peru, and then a couple of degrees colder on the side of the opposite side around Philippines. These, you know, 2 degrees sound nothing, but it has a huge implications on how much evaporation happens on that side, and more rain on that side, and then vice versa. La Niña is the opposite, where it's becoming colder in Peru and warm. So all this, the Mediterranean doesn't have this phenomenon.
Okay.
But if we go into the details, the essence of the, you know, how fluids work, the physics are the same.
Mm-hmm.
So at some point when you know, if you really try to understand how fluids work, the building blocks of this understanding are the same. And then yeah. they're the same if you are applying it to the Mediterranean, the mm-hmm. Pacific, or the ocean in Enceladus, the moon of Jupiter. Like, okay. it would be the same. Like, okay. the fluids work similarly.
Okay.
Different temperatures, different densities, perhaps different bathymetry around it, different mm-hmm. salinity. But, you know, but it will obey the same rules in the mm-hmm. end. So that's what I'm striving, like, to okay. understand the fundamentals and then apply it anywhere, or make the climate models, you know, capture what we think is the most important processes mm-hmm. to be able to project the climate and predict it better.
Be interesting to see the comparisons with the planets. It was Jupiter, you said, or this?
I mentioned Enceladus, which we know it has an icy ocean, like wow. there's an ocean below. Yeah.
I'm not going to go into that now because it's going to totally confuse me. That's fascinating. Look, and I know that you're now you are moving to Melbourne, correct?
Yep, I'm moving to Melbourne in okay. 1st of June, actually.
Yeah, this is I must remind you, it was 7 years in a row the world's most livable city, and this year was the third most livable city. I hope you enjoy Melbourne.
It was the third because I was not there.
Yeah. No, yeah, it's definitely. I know we'll be there soon as well. Yeah. So
I'm gonna enhance. We are both gonna enhance.
Look and look, Melbourne now, High Street, Northcote, Thornbury, and Preston is the world's coolest street. Got voted a couple of weeks ago.
Oh, wow.
High Street in the northern suburbs. It also was Brunswick East was one of the world's coolest suburbs. Melbourne as a whole. Third most livable city.
You're giving me ideas for where to look for.
Yeah, so I'm plugging, and these are all my areas too. So I'm very proud of them. But also, Melbourne got voted the world's friendliest city, which I must admit surprised me because I've been traveling through Asia. I'm sure they're friendlier than Melbourne. But look, I'm thinking.
Depends who vote. Who are the voters for this?
That's
election.
The scientist in you. See, I'm the politician. I take it on face value.
Yeah.
Look, thank you so much for spending this time with me. Thank you so much for this recording. I'm looking forward to hearing feedback from people listening in.
You're very welcome.
I wish you the very best of luck in Melbourne. Melbourne's very lucky to have you.
Oh, thanks.
And you're going to absolutely love the oceans off the coast of Victoria because they are very unique. They are spectacular. They're cold, but
it's all right.
Marvelous.
We have wetsuits.
Exactly. Thank you so much, Navid.
Thank you very much.
Talk again soon.
It's been a pleasure.
Thank
you. See
you.
Bye.
The first trilingual podcast station of Cyprus. Island Talks. Open. Diverse. Free.